Kinjai, Nantakoti Vaishnava Kinjai, Namacharya Shivaharidas Thakur Kinjai, Jain Shiko Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakti Rindu Kinjai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Bhagavina, Shana Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Kinjai, Vrindavan Dham Kinjai, Churjam Kinjai, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Shri Prabhupada and Mahavishnu Padaya. Vishnu Krishnaya Kuntalation, Mate Bhakti Nanda Swami Kinamani. Namaste, Saraswati Devani Gauravani Kutarni, Nipsasa Sundarbhadi Kaskatyadi Satani. Vande Nam Sri Guru Sri Utapad, Nam Sri Guru Nam Nam Chat, Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagina, Ravitam Vikamatam Sajitam, Sagvaitam Sajitam, Krishna Sarika, Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha, Krishna Padam Sagana, Lavita, Sri Krishna Kuntam Chat. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Between Jena Bharat and Maharaj Rupana, I'm going to read through text 2. So, summary. In this chapter, Bharat Maharaj, now Jena Bharat, was successfully accepted by King Rupana, ruler of the states known as Sindhu and Sovira. The king forced Jena Bharat to carry his palanquin and chastised him because he did not carry it properly. A carrier of King Rupana's palanquin was needed. And to fulfill this need, the chief carriers found Jena Bharat as the most likely person to do the work. He was therefore forced to carry the palanquin. Jena Bharat, however, did not protest this proud order, but humbly accepted the job and carried the palanquin. While carrying it, however, he was very careful to see that he did not step on an ant, and whenever he saw one, he would stop until the ant had passed. Because of this, he could not keep pace with the other carriers. The king within the palanquin became very disturbed and chastised Jena Bharat with filthy language. That was interesting because the language that Maharaj Rupana used we wouldn't consider today to be filthy language. We just consider being normal. But Jena Bharat, being completely freed from the bodily conception, did not protest, but proceeded carrying the palanquin. When he continued as before, the king threatened him with punishment. And being threatened by the king, Jena Bharat began to talk. He protested against the filthy language used by the king when the king chastised him, and the king, hearing the instructions of Jena Bharat, was awakened to his real knowledge. When he came to his consciousness, he understood that he had offended a great, learned, and saintly person. At that time, he very humbly and respectfully prayed to Jena Bharat. He now wanted to understand the deep meaning of the philosophical words used by Jena Bharat, and with great sincerity, he begged his pardon. He admitted that if one offends the lotus feet of a pure devotee, he is certainly punished by the trident of Lord Shiva. Text 1, Tristuga Uvacha, Atas Sindhu Sorvira Pate, Raghugan Asya Vrajata Ikshumatyas Tate, Takula Patina Shipika Vaha, Purusan ve sana samaya dai veno pasaditasa dvijavara upalabda eshapiva yuva samhan an ango go karavad gruvam vodham alam iti purva vishtigri tai sahagrit grihita prasabha atad arha uvaha shibikam sa mahanu bhavaha. Word for word, Shri Sukha Uvacha. Shukadeva Goswami continued to speak. Pataha. Thus. Sindhu Sovira Pataha. Of the ruler of the states known as Sindhu and Sovira. Rahu Ganasya. The king known as Rahugana. Rajataha. While going to the ashrama of Kapila. Ikshu Matya Tate. On the bank of the river known as Ikshumati. Tat Kula Patina. By the leader of the palanquin carriers. Shivika Vaha. To become a carrier of the palanquin. Purusha Anveshana Samaye. At the time of searching for a man. Daivena. By chance. Upasaditaha. Led near. Saha. That. Dvijavara. Jetabharata, son of a Brahmana. Upalabdaha. Obtain. Aishaha. This man. Piva. Very strong and stout. Yuva. Young. Samhanana Anga. Having very firm limbs. Go Karavat. Like a cow or an ass. Dhruvam. A load. Vodum. To carry. Alum. Able. Iti. Thus thinking. Purva Vishti Grihitai. Others who were formerly forced to do the task. Saha. With. Grihitaha. Being taken. Pasabam. By force. Atat Arha. Although not fit for carrying the caliphate. Uvaha. Carried. Shibikam. The palanquin. Saha. He. Maha Anubhavaha. A great soul. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Sukadeva Goswami continued. My dear king, after this, King Rahugana, ruler of the states known as Sindhu and Sovira, was going to Kapila Ashrama. When the king's chief palanquin carriers reached the banks of the river Ikshumati, they needed another carrier. Therefore, they began searching for someone, and by chance they came upon Jetabharata. They considered the fact that Jetabharata was very young and strong and had firm limbs. Like cows and asses, he was quite fit to carry loads. Thinking in this way, although the great soul Jetabharata was unfit for such work, they nonetheless unhesitatingly forced him to carry the palanquin. So it's explained later on in the story that King Rahugana wasn't paying any salary to these palanquin carriers. They were slaves. And they were being forced. So this is not proper behavior. If somebody forces you to do something against your will and doesn't even pay you for it, and generally you're not going to be happy about it. You're not going to be compliant. And here we find that Jetabharata is compliant. Now, not only is he forced against his will and without salary, but the work is not suitable for him. So generally, the king is supposed to make sure that everyone is engaged according to work that is suitable for them. Prabhupada says it's the government and the king that is supposed to institute Varnashram. So here they're thinking externally that it's suitable because he's young and he's strong and he's fit and he seems to be mentally deficient. But they're not considering that his deeper qualities make him unfit for this kind of service. So they're not taking the time to ascertain whether or not this is actually the proper service. Now, Srila Prabhupada doesn't have any purport to this verse, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur does. And he makes the point that Jetabharata has been showing kindness his whole life. This is leading up to the next verse of purport. So he said his brothers, remember his stepbrothers, right? He had one full sister, we don't hear much about. And then he had nine stepbrothers. And what did they do to him after the death of his father and mother? They gave him not nice things to eat, worm-eaten grain, the burnt things that had stuck to the bottom of the pot, things like that. What else did they do?
They made him work in the fields.
They made him do very harsh work. He didn't feed him nicely. But Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur said that by allowing his brothers to see his form for a long time, he benedicted them. So he didn't just run away from home. Even though he was being mistreated, he stayed there because the body of a Mahabhagavat is also spiritualized, like the iron put into the fire. Of course, we don't see this very often. Who here has ever seen a blacksmith? Anybody here ever seen a blacksmith? Okay, so a few of us. You see when the iron is put in the fire, it starts glowing red, and if you touch it to anything, it would immediately ignite. So we have a little idea that you can get just as burned from a pot on the stove as you can from the stove itself, that the metal pot becomes also hot. So the body of a pure devotee, when used in the service of the Lord, acts spiritually. This is, of course, explained very nicely in Bhagavad Gita 4.24. Everything becomes transcendental. So just by seeing him. Now, those brothers, what mode of nature do you think the brothers were in?
Passion.
Passion. The mode of passion? They were engaged in the Vedic rituals, but for what purpose?
Enjoyment.
Enjoyment. And so after someone in the mode of ignorance, they do the wrong thing for the wrong purpose. In the mode of good, the mode of passion, you do the right thing for the wrong reason. And the mode of goodness, you do the right thing for the right reason. So the mode of the activities of one in the mode of passion and one in the mode of goodness are very similar. But the consciousness is very different. So they were performing the Vedic rituals. They were Brahmanas. They were studying the scriptures. But their mentality was enjoyment. So they were in Rajagun. But then we have the Dacoits. So what mode are they in? That's easy. They were in the mode of goodness. So there also, Jed Bharata, according to Vishnu Chakravarti, was merciful to them by again letting them see him. And who else did they see? They saw somebody else. Kali. They saw Kali. So there was, that's not ordinary. And by the benediction of seeing both Jed Bharata and Kali, in their next life they would get liberation. Now, Maharaj is actually a jnani. He's going to the ashram of Kapiladeva. He's a Rajarishi. He's not an ordinary king. And he's in the mode of Satvaguna. Although, in his work as a king, he has to exhibit some, superficially some of the attitudes of Rajaguna. Raja means also king, the mode of a king. So although he's a Rajarishi, he's externally, superficially acting in Rajagun. But Jed Bharata, knowing that Maharaj Arugana was actually in Satvagun, he is going to benedict him with Gyan and Bhakti. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says this particular part of the story shows how by the mercy of Krishna, Jed Bharata's own Bhakti and Gyan and Vairagya get multiplied 100 times. Okay, so we're going to go to text 2. And I'm not going to read the Sanskrit. The palanquin, however, was very erratically carried by Jeda Bharata due to his sense of non-violence. As he stepped forward, he checked before him every 3 feet to see whether he was about to step on ants. Consequently, he could not keep pace with the other carriers. So that you can imagine the palanquin is going in a jerky fashion. It's starting and stopping. And if you've ever tried to keep pace with somebody when you're walking, and if you're walking in a different speed. Due to this, the palanquin was shaking, and King Rahugan immediately asked the carriers, "Why are you carrying this palanquin unevenly? Better carry it properly." So by the way, in the Sanskrit, it says, Ishumatra, the measurement of an arrow. So he was always looking ahead. Avaloka Anugatehe, Anugate, before he was going, Avaloka, he's looking before he was going, the length of one arrow, which is about 3 feet. Now, there's nothing in the Sanskrit about the ants. But the idea is that he wasn't just walking. He was looking carefully ahead before walking. And therefore, at least Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada both have determined that the reason he was looking this carefully before stepping was to be careful of the little creatures on the path. It's purport. Although Jeda Bharata was forced to carry the palanquin. Now, is that a
pleasant situation. Would you want to be forced, without pay, to do something for which you're not suited? So though Jenna Barge was forced to carry the palanquin, he did not give up his sympathetic feelings toward the poor ants passing on the road. So he didn't lose his good qualities. So this is our third instance. First instance, his brothers are mistreating him. He doesn't lose his good qualities. Next instance, the dacoits were really mistreating him. I doubt that any of us, even if we've gone through horrific situations in our life, were ever about to be sacrificed. And still he didn't lose his good qualities. And now again, he's being misused, and this, it will increase. He doesn't give up his good qualities. A devotee of the Lord does not forget his devotional service and other favorable activities. So he doesn't forget his bhakti, and he also doesn't forget how to just act in a proper way. He doesn't forget his good qualities, even when he is in a most distressful condition. Jet Bharata was a qualified brahmana, highly elevated in spiritual knowledge, yet he was forced to carry the palanquin. He did not mind this. But while walking on the road, he could not forget his duty to avoid killing even an ant. So we see here that even one situated in pure bhakti, they don't give up the qualities of a devotee. It's not that bhakti is an excuse to be road ignorance. A Vaishnava is never envious or unnecessarily violent. There were many ants on the path, but Jaya Bharata took care by looking ahead 3 feet. When the ants were no longer in the way, he would place his foot on the ground. A Vaishnava is always very kind at heart to all living entities. In his Sankhya Yoga, Lord Kapila Dev explains, Suridam Sarvadehina. Living entities assume different bodily forms. Those who are not Vaishnavas consider only human society worthy of their sympathy. And of course, many don't even consider all of human society worthy of their sympathy. But Krishna claims to be the supreme father of all life forms. Consequently, the Vaishnava takes care not to annihilate untimely or unnecessarily any life form. All living entities have to fulfill a certain duration for being encaged in a particular type of material body. They have to finish the duration allotted for a particular body before being promoted or evolved to another body. Killing an animal or any other living being simply places an impediment in the way of his completing his term of imprisonment in a certain body. One should therefore not kill bodies for one's sense gratification, for this will implicate one in sinful activity. So here we see the Jet Bharata as merciful and kind to those in Rajagun, Tamagun, Sattvagun, human bodies, non-human bodies, even so insignificant as an ant. Even when he's personally in a situation of great distress. So first of all, he doesn't show mercy only to certain types of living entities. He shows mercy to all. And secondly, his mercy is not contingent on his own state. It's not contingent on his own circumstances. He's always merciful, unconditionally merciful. So this is not the general mode of a materialistic person. A materialistic person is usually only kind when they want something. And usually only kind is some sort of an exchange. Also, they're generally only kind selectively. So they're kind in selective circumstances, and they're kind to selective entities. They're kind to their own family and not others, to their own kind. Something that they consider their own kind. And if those two things are not there, or if even one of them is not there, if it's not my kind, or if I'm in distress, then all of a sudden I'm not merciful. So if I'm in distress, I may lack mercy even to my own kind. And even when I'm happy, I may not be merciful to those who are not my own kind. So think about, say, Kamsa. When Narada came, Kamsa was very respectful to Narada. But that respect, we heard Radha Swami talking about this recently in Chakrati, was like a payment to Narada. He wanted some information. Therefore, he treated him with respect. It's not factually that he had any respect for him. Actually, he thought he was better than everyone, including Narada. But to get something, he superficially showed respect. Right? Or Indra. Indra wanted the return of the earrings and umbrella from the heavenly planets. So he came to Krishna with great respect. you know, please help me get these. And when Krishna delivered them from Bhomasura, Indra was also very respectful. And then as soon as Krishna took a Parijata tree, then Indra started to fight him. Even though Indra supposedly learned his lesson from the Govardhan Lila. Still, as soon as he didn't want something anymore, then all of the respect went out the window. We find Balabhacharya, when he wanted Mahaprabhu to hear his commentary, he was very respectful. And as soon as Mahaprabhu wouldn't hear his commentary, immediately he became disrespectful. So we can consider that generally when we're kind to others, it's because we want something. Either we want something from that entity in particular, or we want something from our general community, or even if we're thinking about the law of karma, which is better than not thinking about the law of karma, by the way. I mean, it's much better to be a karmi than a vikarmi. It's a huge step up. So we're not denigrating karma kanda. In the modern society, most people are vikarmis. And if they could come to karma kanda, it would be a huge leap. And at least we in the Hare Krishna movement, at least we who claim to be Vaishnavas, at least we should be acting on the level of karma kanda. We shouldn't be vikarmis. So someone on the level of karma kanda, they're thinking, I better be nice so that I'll get something nice in return. You know, so this person is being nasty to me, but if I retaliate, or I have nothing to gain in the situation, but if I'm not kind, then I will also suffer in the future. Like that several months ago, one devotee said, why do I have to learn through suffering? I said, well, what do you desire for your enemies? So if you desire your so-called enemies to learn through suffering, then you'll get that back. It's karma. That's explained in the fourth canto from Suniti to Dhruva Maharaj. But all of those are material calculations. Again, that's better than thinking I'm just going to do whatever I want and I don't care what happens. You know, I'm just going to step on people and hurt people and I don't care about any kind of reactions. But it certainly isn't spiritual. And then it gets very conditional, right? As soon as the person has nothing left to give, as soon as we have nothing to gain, then we have no more reason to behave in a merciful way. So we may look at circumstance, right? We have like Kamsa, you know, as soon as he was afraid, then he was killing his own nephews. As soon as Jamadagni was thinking, oh, my wife is looking at another man, he wanted to kill his own wife. As soon as Dusmanta's son, Bharat's wives, gave birth to children that didn't look like their husband, they killed them. Oh, we might get in trouble with our husband. As soon as Chitraketu's wives saw that, oh, my husband's not giving me the same amount of attention, so they killed their stepson. There were all these instances of people who went against even their own family members in a time of distress. So even up to that point, I mean, generally, even when we're in distress, we're at least kind to our own kind. Swajana, like Arjuna said in Bhagavad Gita, Swajana, these are my people. Duryodhana is also my people. How can I kill my people? So when we're going to say mine, we can think of all humans. Well, I'll be nice to humans, but we'll kill the cows and the pigs and the chickens and the goats and etc. So this is very common. Nowadays, when people are just saying, yes, I care about people, I'm a good person, and I can be a mediator at the same time, they don't see a contradiction. I remember the Rath Yatra, I was talking to this one woman who was saying, yes, Jesus says to love your neighbor. So who's your neighbor? I said, is your neighbor only other humans? Are they only other American humans? Are they only other American Catholic humans? You know? And some people, they're wide enough that they may think about everyone as their family, even the ants and the porpoises and the tuna fish and whatever. But then when they're in distress, they'll go against even their own kind. So we have, you know, this sort of selected mercy. I'm merciful if I want something. Or I'm merciful if you're one of my own kind. One of my own kind means it's like I'm thinking you're an extension of myself. But we find that even in distress, once a person gets in distress, they'll give up mercy even to their own kind. Right? They'll attack their own kind. But here we find that Bharat Maharaj, he's merciful to those who are not his own kind, not even significant. I mean, who cares if an aunt dies? Do you have a funeral? You bury the body? And we've often thought about this, you know, all living entities are equal, Pandita Samadarshinaha. But when a human dies, generally, unless there's some emergency, we give a lot of respect to the body of a human. You know, it's considered really horrible if there's some sort of great catastrophe and they have to put humans into a mass grave, human bodies into a mass grave without ceremony. Even I was reading one article recently about how there's this graveyard in America, I think in Texas, for criminals whose families refused to pay the money to bury them. And some of these are people who were executed by the government, and some are just people who died in prison, and people who committed, you know, serial rapes and murders, and people who committed really horrendous crimes, but they're buried by the government with honor, at government expense, you know, $2,000 per funeral. And how they say often the only people at the burial are the prison wardens and the persons, the other criminals who are digging the grave. But still they have some sense that the body of a human being should be treated with dignity. Which we don't think like that, you know, for even mammals. What to speak of insects? You know, if some insect goes on the windshield of your car, you don't even take notice of it. It's just a botheration that you have to clean it off the windshield, and there's some dead bug on the ground. You don't think, well, let me give dignity to this soul by giving them a proper funeral. So they're very insignificant. What you know, what value do they have? There's no Save the Ants Foundation. You know, it's just... But he's being kind even to the ants, even to the little bugs. And not only that he's in distress, but being kind is putting him further in distress. Not only is he in a distress condition, but by showing kindness to the ants, he's getting in trouble. So I mean, if we think about, honestly, when are we kind? To whom are we kind? Under what circumstances are we kind? And if being kind to somebody is going to get us in trouble, will we do it? What I've seen, even in our Hare Krishna movement, is if somebody is accused of doing something wrong, even if it's not proven, everybody backs away from that person. Just back away. They think, I don't want to be shown as, I don't want to be seen as doing any kindness for this person. I might be associated with them somehow. We would really hesitate to show kindness to somebody, to show mercy to somebody, if it may cause us some kind of harm. And even when that's not the case, if we're just very distressed, if we're sick and we're in a lot of pain, it's very hard to think about caring for other people. We just want other people to care for us. Or from a lot of mental anxiety. Well, the other day at the parents' meeting, one of the fathers asked, is it harmful for children to see the mother and father fighting in front of them? And I said, well, certainly you shouldn't be nasty to each other. There may be some benefit for children to see my parents can have an argument and still love each other. I said, but don't have contempt for each other. I said, you never have contempt for anyone else. The main predictor of divorce is how contemptuous the two people are, by the way. What
does it mean?
Contempt? You think you're better than somebody else. So there are psychologists who become so expert that they can look at a 20-second video of a husband and wife talking, and by measuring the amount of contempt, they can say how many years that couple's going to stay together. And they've got about a 90% rate of being able to predict that, just from contempt. So I said, you shouldn't have any contempt for each other, even in private, but to speak it in front of your children. And this devotee said, well, how do you avoid that? You know, when you're angry, you're going to say contemptuous, nasty things. So even when we're angry that we never cause harm to another living entity, we don't use it as an excuse. Well, I'm angry, therefore I don't have to be kind anymore. I'm in physical pain, I don't have to be kind anymore. I'm in mental pain, I don't have to be kind anymore. I'm in poverty, I don't have to be kind anymore. You know, I can get to a point of distress where all I think about is myself. So these are our challenges. First of all, are we only kind to those who are like us? Are we only kind to those of our gender, those of our religion, those of our species, those of our nationality, those of our political persuasion, those of our philosophical persuasion? You know, do we have a group that we're kind to or unkind to everyone else? Then are we only kind when we want something, when there's some benefit in it for us, or are we kind even when we have nothing to gain at all? Are we kind when we're in such distress that it's hard to think about anybody else but ourselves? That we, you know, extreme distress blocks out everything else. I'm sure you've all noticed that. Really, really extreme distress. You can hardly notice anything else. It's almost like you're a horse with blinders on. Are we still kind to others? And are we kind to others when being kind to others is going to cause or increase our distress? So if you look at all of these, you'll see that they all come from fear. All of these reasons for being unkind to others, they're all fear-based. So if I'm kind to others when I want to get something, then I'm afraid, thinking I need something from that person. If I don't get this thing from that person, I'll lack in some way. There'll be something deficient. I'm not understanding the first mantra of the Ishopanishad. Purnasya pranam anaya. From the complete, many complete units have come. I feel an illusion to be incomplete. And therefore I make a false show of kindness. This is a very heavy thing to say because we don't generally think it's a false show. But you know it's a false show because as soon as you don't think you're going to get what you want, the kindness goes out the window. Therefore, we say it's not real love. So if my love is contingent, then it's fear-based. I have to be loving or I won't get what I need. I have to be loving or I won't get what I need. I have to be loving or I won't get what I need. If we're only kind to those, merciful to those who are of our own kind, then that's also very fear-based. I'm seeing the world in terms of us and them, of friends and enemies. I'm thinking these other entities, because they're like me, they're going to want to do things for me. We're all in the same group. It's a false way of seeing that I'm part of Krishna. Instead of I'm part of Krishna, I'm part of this, you know, I'm an Italian, or I'm a man, or I'm a human, or I'm an earthling, or something like that. You know, so just like I know that by giving to the whole of Krishna, I become satisfied, and I pervert that. That if I give to Italy, I become satisfied. Or if I give to, you know, Serbia, I become satisfied. Or if I give to all the other Lutheran Protestants, I become satisfied. And those others who are not me, they will hurt me. So those who are me, they will give to me. They will give to the whole of which I am a part, and I will also benefit. And those who are not me, they're going to take away from the whole of which I am a part, and I will be harmed. So that's why we give to those who are like me. And in distress, it's also fear-based. I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm in distress, I have to take care of myself. Otherwise, who's going to take care of me? And up to the point that it's okay to hurt others, it's okay either by omission, I'm just not going to look to see if there's ants on the ground, and if some of them get stepped on, oh well, what can I do? After all, I'm being forced to carry this palanquin. It's the fault of the king. It's the fault of the other palanquin carriers. Surely it's not my fault. I'm obliged. I'm being obliged. I'm going to be punished if I don't. And I don't want to step on the ants, but I don't know how to avoid that. So that's omission. Or commission. Let me intentionally give pain to others in order to avoid pain myself, in order to protect myself. Let me knowingly, intentionally say something harmful, do something harmful, hurt somebody, even those who are like, up to the point of even someone who's like me. So the highest level of lack of mercy is that I heard my swajana, I heard those who are like me intentionally. I kill my own child. I kill my own mother. Just to get something. That's the utmost expression of lack of mercy. The most difficult even for a materialistic person to comprehend. You know, we can understand why you would kill an enemy, but why would you kill one of your own? And the closer it gets to you, why would you do that even under distress? But under great distress, a person will do that. I don't know if I mentioned here, but when I was getting my undergraduate degree, I had to read a book on the Holocaust called Night by Elie Wiesel, who won a Nobel Prize for his writing. And he was put into Auschwitz concentration camp at the age of 15. And as they went into the camp, the female family members, his mother and sisters, were immediately pushed alive into a pit of fire and burned alive in front of him at the age of 15. Then he and his father were working in the camp on starvation rations. They were given just enough food to live. And you know, they're getting skinnier and weaker, and they're having to do hard physical labor. And when the Allied forces were coming in, the Nazis took all of the prisoners and put them in cattle cars and were moving them out of the camp so the Allies wouldn't discover their crimes. And in these cars, it was the winter. It was about as cold as it is now. It was snowing. And the cattle cars were open at the top, so the snow was falling in. And these people were literally skin and bones, so they were very cold. And many of them died on the way just from the cold. So that at every stop they'd have to take out, they'd say, throw out the horses, and they just throw out the dead bodies and leave them in the snow. And they didn't have any facility in the cars. There was no food, there was no water, there was no toilet facilities, and they crammed the people into the cars as tightly as they possibly could. So at some stations, the local German people, knowing that there were people in the cars, would throw food over the tops of the cars. And Elie Wiesel, talked about how sometimes people will throw money to poor children and watch them scramble for it. Or sometimes you may throw food to animals and you watch them fight over the food. So they were taking pleasure in throwing the food into the cars and watching the people fight for the food, because it wasn't enough for everybody. And Elie Wiesel saw one boy, in going to catch the food, inadvertently actually killed his own father. You know, he just like knocked his father to the side in order to grab some bread. And Elie Wiesel at the time was thinking, I hope I never get to that point. You know, I hope I never lose my humanity to that point. His father, actually, when they stopped the cars, he and his father were walking through the snow, and his father died while they were walking. So our college professor asked us, he said, you know, what would you do if you were in that situation? How would you behave? And I had to just say, I don't know. I hope I never have to find out. But we come to a situation where the fear is great enough that we give up all of our good qualities. So I thought I'd take a little risk here, and I'd read something from a Christian theologian, C.S. Lewis, on the relationship of fear to good qualities. He says, cowardice alone of all the vices is purely painful, horrible to anticipate, horrible to feel, horrible to remember. Hatred has its pleasures. It is therefore often the compensation by which a frightened person reimburses him or herself for the miseries of fear. The more one fears, the more one will hate, and hatred is also a great painkiller for shame. People can be proud of most vices, but not of cowardice. Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the point of highest reality. A chastity or honesty or mercy which yields to danger will be chaste or honest or merciful only on conditions. So this statement to me was the answer as to why we say the non-devotees have no good qualities. If you have fear, then you only have that good quality as long as it doesn't make you afraid. As soon as you come to a point of enough fear, of enough threat, where having that good quality becomes a threat, you jettison that good quality. Okay, I care about the ants, but if caring about the ants means that the king is going to beat me, I don't care about the ants anymore. So therefore, I don't really care about the ants. Who do I really care about? Myself. Therefore, I don't actually have any good qualities. So the more one is free from fear, to that extent one manifests good qualities. Like we said, it's a testing point. So where is the testing point? A very fearful person has a very low testing point. I'm sure we've all met people like this. It doesn't take much for them to become angry and hateful and nasty and hurtful. And just some very small thing. I saw even, not too long ago, one devotee where he felt he was being threatened. He felt his reputation was being threatened. And to protect his own reputation, he publicly wrote things criticizing his own children to protect himself. Even though actually his reputation wasn't being threatened, it was astonishing. And he went into this hatred to cover his own cowardice, to cover his own shame and his own fear. So the less fear one has, the longer, in the more trying circumstances, in the more difficult circumstances, one will still manifest mercy. But as long as there's any fear, there'll be a testing point. There'll be a point at which we give up our good qualities. And then we're filled with shame. I really like how C.S. Lewis says here that nobody values cowardice. Even the demons don't value cowardice. You know, the demons may be proud of their greed and their lust and their anger. They are actually often proud of these things. But nobody's proud of being a coward. And so they cover this deep shame of cowardice with hatred. Now, I hate the other party, and that's why I can't be merciful to them. Then he goes on to say, C.S. Lewis goes on to say, how do people end up doing cowardly things? They plan for all sorts of ways to stay safe in various contingencies. So they say, well, if this happened, although I very much hope it won't happen, I could do this. And if the worst came to the worst, then I could do this. A person thus feels that he or she has something other than Krishna and the courage that Krishna supplies to fall back on. So that what was intended to be a total commitment becomes honeycombed all through with little unconscious reservations. By building up a series of imaginary expedients to prevent the worst coming to the worst, a person develops below conscious awareness, a determination that the worst shall not come to the worst. Then, when there is real terror, the fear rushes into the nerves and muscles, and the act of cowardice is done. Well, I really like his psychological analysis. That what we do, instead of depending on Krishna, instead of having Krishna as our shelter, instead of feeling complete with Krishna, we instead go to plan making. And we say, well, okay, let's see. If I run out of money, I can do this. If they throw me out of the temple, I can do this. If none of my friends love me anymore, I can do this. If my wife leaves me, I can do this. If my husband leaves me, I can do this. If I get some really bad disease, I can do this. And then, well, suppose that doesn't work. Well, then I can do that. Well, suppose the absolute worst comes to the worst, you know, and I'm homeless eating out of garbage cans and I'm quadriplegic and nobody loves me anymore and I'm covered with maggots and I can't talk to you. Then I'll do this. Okay. So probably terrible things will not happen because statistically it probably won't happen. It's probably okay. But if it does, I've got this plan and this plan and this plan and this plan and this person I can depend on and this place I can go to and I have my secret Swiss bank account and I have my thing over here and I have my extra set of shoes and, you know, but one thing about traveling light is you lose a lot of those contingency plans. You know, I've reduced my luggage by the grace of the airlines who now charge for more and more things. When I first started traveling, it was with a lot of stuff. And gradually I've reduced, you know, I don't have very many contingency plans anymore, at least not with me. You know, if my shoes get taken, or this happens, or that happens, I don't have a lot of wiggle room. And it forces you to say, what's my shelter? You know, but still we may continue, well, I can get it, I can do this. I'm usually in a place that I just buy another toothbrush. I always do. You think about Radha Swami's book, The Journey Home, where he had to keep getting rid of things. You know, he had to get rid of the sleeping bag because this lady's bodyguard was going to kill him. He had to get rid of his shoes because the Naga Babas was threatening him. Somebody stole his bag of books. You know, pretty soon he just had two little cloths and his passport. He didn't have any money. That's why Prabhupada says that the sannyasi must be fearless. He says, unless you're fearless, you don't take sannyas. Because you won't be able to do it, not real sannyas. That's what real sannyas is. You don't have, you've given up all your contingency plans. You've cut your tie to your family. You've cut your tie to society. You've cut your tie to your income, to your home. You're traveling with just a stick and a water pot and maybe a little bag of clothes. We don't know how you travel from South India with a servant who carried four sets of clothes. A little something. You know, but you've cut your contingency plans. You don't know where you're going to stay. You don't have it all prearranged. And if you're not fearless, how can you do it? You know, you fall apart. So to really become Suridam Sarvadevi Nun, we'd like to be that, wouldn't we? I mean, aren't we? Don't we feel ashamed when we mistreat others out of our own fear? It's so embarrassing. I think of all the things that embarrass us, whatever bad habits we have, and whatever things we're struggling with, I think the thing that fills us the most with shame is our mistreatment of other living beings. So how to do this? I mean, you know, one can take courses on how to be nice to people, and we're not denigrating that. That's not a bad thing. And especially if we come from families or society where we don't even know how to be nice to people. So that's useful. But that in and of itself is not going to solve the essential problem. The essential problem is that I'm filled with fear. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Prabhupada would sometimes say eating, sleeping, mating, and fearing. And he would say that fear is the basic component of material life. So why am I afraid? I'm afraid because I think that I'm this body, and this body is very fragile. I mean, it's really fragile. It's almost like we're walking inside of a glass case. You know, any little knock or jolt or fall or... And we can have consequences for the rest of our life. Just some little tiny microbe, you know, and then we're just... Things that we can't even prevent against. How am I going to prevent getting some little tiny disease from something? Or having some sort of accident? So if I think that I'm dependent on this body, then that alone is always going to make me fearful. And then what about all the mental things that I've accumulated, all my knowledge, all my resources? You know, that can also be gone in a moment, will be gone in a moment. All the relationships that I've made, we talked about this the other day, how, you know, after death, those relationships are gone. You know, so I rebuilt out this whole network of relationships that I feel is my shelter, but that's not solid. I mean, people who like me today cannot like me tomorrow. It happens. And vice versa, too. People who are my enemies today may be my friends tomorrow. It's not solid, or they may die, or something. And they may be busy with their own lives. I can't really depend on those. I can't depend even on the earth. You know, there's earthquakes and storms and tsunamis, and I can't depend on anything. So we're always in fear. As soon as I think that I'm this body and I'm part of this world and this life and this identity is my shelter, then I'm filled with fear. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada would say, the only solution is Krishna consciousness. That's not some sort of a sectarian statement or some sort of fanatic statement. If you even just want to be a consistently nice person, you have to ultimately be Krishna conscious. You can't be a consistently nice person, even to your family. It's an embodied concept of life. Because if it's threatened enough, you won't be nice anymore. So very wonderful in the Majjha Lila 2450, Mahaprabhu is quoting Lord Ramachandra, saying, it is my vow that if one only once seriously surrenders unto me, saying, my dear Lord, from this day I am yours, and prays to me for courage, as immediately award courage to that person, and he will always remain safe from that day on. So this is how to deal with any of the struggles that we have. This is it's the one key, it's the one panacea for everything. Not only our mistreatment of others, but our mistreatment of ourselves. Some of us have habits that are cruel to ourselves also. Also out of fear. To ask for courage. I had one devotee who was saying to me, I have such trouble getting angry, how do I deal with it? I said, pray for courage. She said, what does one have to do for the other? I said, just do it. And she looked back and she said, it worked. Why did it work? How did it work? And only to depend on Krishna and the courage Krishna gives us. I mean, we have some responsibility to make some plans. If you're going to build a temple, you have to plan to earn the money to build a temple. I mean, like we're going to be traveling tomorrow and you make some plans, you buy a ticket, and etc. But not that those plans are what's giving us shelter. That my safety is in Krishna, and my safety is in the courage that Krishna gives me. And when our mind goes, what about this, what about this? Krishna just gives me courage. Courage is another word for faith and trust. And when one is filled with courage, one feels peaceful. The opposite of fear is peace. That one actually understands, nobody can hurt me, nothing can hurt me. No material facility or lack of it can ever harm me. I can't be harmed by physical illness or physical disability. I can't be harmed by mental anguish. I can't be harmed by a bad reputation. I can't be harmed by a lack of love within my community or my family. I have nothing to do with any of those things. They're not a threat to me. And Jed Bard was fixed in this consciousness. That nothing can hurt me, doesn't matter. My happiness is within. Whatever Krishna wants to do with me, I have the courage, I have the faith, I have the trust that whatever he wants to do with me is all right. And then we can live up to our ideal in all circumstances. Otherwise, we live up to our ideal, we live up to our ideal, we live up to our ideal. Boom, we don't live up to our ideal anymore. And we say, well, how did that happen? And we can make, and I'm not saying again that one shouldn't make other plans also as part of our service. But that's not going to really solve the problem by itself. Just making sure there's no cakes in your refrigerator, or putting your computer in the living room instead of in your own room, whatever it may be to deal with, or whatever stuff it is that we deal with. That alone isn't going to deal with what's really pushing us to be less than what we want, which is our fear. And once one comes to fearlessness, then in whatever external ashram one is practically a sannyasi. And from that point, Brahmabhutta prasannatmana sarjatina kamsi sama sarvesha bhute shumad bhakti mabhate gram. Only from that point can we have real bhakti. Only from that point can we have real joy. You can't have real joy mixed with fear. It just doesn't work. It's like sweet rice mixed with sand. You just can't do it. Give me a nice plate of prasad with a police officer standing behind me saying, I'm just waiting for the word from headquarters to arrest you. How can I enjoy my Guru-Arjuna? I'm going to try to beat it really fast before I get arrested. I won't get any pleasure out of it. You can't enjoy anything when you're full of fear. It's not possible. What to speak of coming to our spiritual joyfulness. Therefore, Krishna says, how can there be any happiness without peace? So that's the beginning of spiritual life, is peace. And not just artificially, I'm peaceful. Mm-hmm. And as soon as there's a threat, you're not peaceful anymore. But by going to Krishna for courage. And then it's not that Jed Bart is just some extraordinary person that has nothing to do with any of us. He's just a soul like any of us. And what he's doing, we can also do. It's not that intrinsically, ontologically, he has some more qualification than anybody here. We all have access to this, if we want to. So I want to thank you very much, and thank you for your hospitality here.
at Bangladesh. I think it's the longest I've ever stayed here in time. I'm really grateful. The idea is I'll come back in May for a few days for the education conference. So again, just a few minutes. Anybody has questions or comments or additions, subtractions? Yes?
Before you come to this point of fearlessness, because it's not going to happen tomorrow.
Why not? It could happen in the next 1 minute if you wanted. Before you come to that point, you'll be fearful, you'll be in anxiety, you won't be peaceful, you won't be able to live up to your ideals. Before you come to that point, all you're doing is getting the faith to make the jump. That's all you're working on. You're just working on becoming convinced that it's something you want to do. Doing it is a matter of a moment. Doing it is an easy matter of one moment. So you can't do it for everything, do it for some things. Become fearless about food, become fearless about money, become fearless about your health, become fearless about your community. Take one part of your life that you have a lot of fear about and make the jump to become fearless about that thing. And then you can try to become fearless, you can make a determination to become fearless about something else. And eventually make the whole jump. The jump is easy, the jump is that's who we are. But it's a lot of what we're doing in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness is convincing each other to make this jump. And looking at people who made the jump and they're swimming and they're happy. They say, come on, it's an ocean of nectar. So far. How do I know there aren't rocks under there? I've heard about people who jumped into water and they broke their neck on rocks. And maybe you just jumped into a good place. Maybe you're just a really good jumper. Anything else? Yes.
So, I was told like Padyatra and this type of activities that they help you.
Definitely.
So it's also pretty, like, other than praying, something like it's pretty practical in that sense.
It's practical to do those sort of things. Now, it's interesting, the external, those sort of external things, they're both a way to develop fearlessness and they're also a symptom of already having fearlessness. Like, one is not supposed to take sannyas as a way to develop fearlessness. One is supposed to take vanprastha as a way to develop fearlessness. And after having developed fearlessness, one takes sannyas. But certainly, those sort of experiences, which is why I say try to do it at least in some area of your life. You can say, okay, Krishna, starting today for the next 3 days. For 3 days, it takes me to worry about. You worry about money. Do you worry about whether or not a certain person likes you, or whether everybody in the temple likes you? Do you worry about whether or not your health is going to fall apart? You know, take something that you're worrying about, especially something that you worry about that really interferes with your bhakti. You know, you're trying to chant japa, and it goes, why not this? Why not this? Why not this? What's going to happen? Be quiet. You know, like you saw yesterday, you might see. You know, so if there's some fear like that, how am I going to pay for the college next year? is this guy I love, is he going to love me? Is he going to love me? Is he going to leave me? Whatever it is, take that thing, take a vow. Okay, for 3 days I'm going to let go of this. I'm just going to let Krishna worry about it. So for the next 3 days, I'm going to do my duty, which may involve working at my job. But I'm going to let Krishna worry about how much money I have. I'm going to let Krishna worry about my health. I'm going to take my medicines. I'm going to do my exercises. But I'm going to let Krishna worry about my health. I had someone talk to me recently, you know, my health's not very good. What if I ended up crippled in my old age and there's no one to take care of me? And I was like, okay, for 3 days I'm going to let Krishna worry about it. I'm not going to obsess about it. I'm going to take a vow like that. And then you can do this externally. To go on padyatra, you don't know where you're going to sleep that night. You don't know where you're sleeping, you're going to sleep, you don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know whether the people in the village you go to are going to throw tomatoes at you or... You know, that's a very good exercise. At least sometimes to do that kind of thing. Or even just to let go of all of your work for a day and just chant.
You know, we're worried that if I just count 16 rounds, I won't get everything else done and I need to get done. So, you know, have a day sometimes. We just put it like we have this kirtan weekend. Just let everything else go. Doesn't matter who's emailing me something. It doesn't matter who's on my to-do list. I'm just going to let go and go into Krishna and figure it all work out, because it does all work out. So that's awesome. And then that gives you the confidence. You say, wow, that wasn't hard. I want to get it. It's so wonderful. You want to keep doing it. You know, after the 3 days, you're like, oh, this is great. And you do it with one thing, and then you do it with another thing. And at some point, we'll do it with everything. At some point, we'll say, okay, I trust you for everything. Yes?
Today, as I feel inspired, take a result to take part in Padayatra networks, and you don't have to go to India all the way.
There you go.
There you go.
So we have just had an advertisement for Padayatra networks. Yes?
Can't fear be also a chance to become more responsible? Because
isn't that interesting? So we generally think like this. We generally think, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because whenever we want to get rid of an anartha and surrender to Krishna, the mind is a machine that has a function to keep us with Krishna. That's its purpose. And we have a mind because we wanted one. We ordered it. Krishna, I want you to forget me. He said, okay, here's a machine that will ensure that you forget me. So the mind is pre-programmed with a lot of arguments as to why we should not possibly let go of our chains to Maya. So we've got all these chains, and we're holding on to them. And the mind says, but fear is useful. Lust is useful. I remember one devotee saw me. He was really struggling. And I said, ask Krishna what the anartha is. He said, oh, I know what it is. I said, no, it isn't. I don't think it is. He said, ask Krishna. And he called me up the next day. He said, it's gross lust. He said, I never would have thought that's what it is, but it's gross lust. I said, okay, you better get rid of it. He said, but if I did, I'd leave my wife. And I'd be irresponsible. I said, no, you wouldn't. That's the mind. So the mind is telling you, well, I've got to be envious. Look at all the things it does for me. I've got to be fearful. Look at what it does for me. It makes me do this and this and this and this and this. I've got to be attached. If I wasn't attached, I'd be irresponsible. I'd be undutiful. I would just leave everybody and go singing through the streets of Navadvip like a madman. I'm going to tell you something. If you actually really let go of everything and actually really fell madly in love with Krishna and actually were singing through the streets of Navadvip like an actual madman in prema, it wouldn't matter whether or not you were materially responsible. Because material responsibilities are a monopoly game. And you can walk away from monopoly games. You don't have to keep playing them. Sarvadharma Pritcha Jama Mikam Sarva Jama Kam Sarvapapa Yama Moksha Shyama Masa Jama. And you know what? We're going to have to walk away from all of our responsibilities anyway when our master calls us. Which could be in 5 minutes. So that's on one level. The other level is even the devotees madly in prema don't generally walk away from their responsibilities. Because it's their service. Not only do they not walk away from their responsibilities, they usually do them much better. Because they're not selfish anymore. How well can I do my responsibilities when I'm selfish? Then I'll do them well sometimes, and when my duties conflict with my selfishness, I won't do them well. We really think, if I have freedom, I'll misuse it? Do we think that badly of ourselves? We really think, if the chains were taken off, you know, I'd just be a wild animal? So I have to be chained? That's really sad. Anyway, don't listen to this. This is mine. This is the illusion. You need the chain. They're good for you. Keep them on. Why do you want freedom? You'll misuse it. Better keep those chains on. You don't see, the chains are what's making us act badly. Fear isn't making us responsible, it's making us cruel and irresponsible. Our real degree of real responsibility is coming from to whatever extent we're free from fear. As I said before, haven't you met very fearful people? Have you met very, very fearful people in your life? Are they responsible, caring people? Are they? Are they nice people to be around? How do extremely fearful people behave? It doesn't take much for them to be cruel, even to their own loved ones. Correct? So what? This is nonsense. My fear is making you responsible. The more fear you have, the less responsible you have. You are. The more you're going to be like a wild animal. And the more peace you have, then you can see things clearly and you act properly. Is that all right? You got to be prepared, you know, because mind will say, oh, you can't surrender today. You need fear. It's good for you. It's like a meat eater who's saying, well, I can't become a vegetarian today. I mean, I need the protein. I mean, I have to be gradual. I have to gradually give it up. Maybe in a year I can become a vegetarian. Okay, and now thank you very much. Our voice is your program.